This is an oral history interview with Dr. Anne Flitcraft, physician and pioneer of medical reform to improve the treatment of survivors of domestic violence. We're going to be talking today about the medical identification, treatment, and prevention of domestic violence in the 1970s, 80s, and beyond. I'm Catherine Jacquet, a historian and postdoctoral fellow at McAllister College. The date is March 3rd, 2014, and this is a phone interview. So, Anne, thank you so much for talking with me today. I appreciate it.
My pleasure.
And so I thought we could start with the basics to get a sense, the basics like when and where you were born and where you grew up. And from there, I'm curious about your path into medicine.
Yeah. I was born and raised in St. Louis, Missouri. My mom was a nurse briefly until she had four children. And my dad was a chemical engineer who worked in all kinds of, worked with early computers, worked with, ended up doing a lot of business administrative work with Monsanto. He's still alive. He's 93 and is working on developing a museum work that was done largely through NASA and how chemical engineers were involved in sort of things on beyond. And I think I always, so that's sort of where science came from in my life, is both from my mom and my dad. I guess I grew up assuming I would go to college. In those days, you sent girls to college just in case something happened, which meant if you lost your husband, then you would be able to get a job. That was why you sent girls to college. But my folks were actually very good and gave me chemistry sets and The Visible Man and learned very quickly that I didn't take to Barbie dolls and sort of supported that part of things. And I did a lot of sciences in high school, weekend science programs and so forth. So they were very supportive about that. And when I went away to college in 1966, I went away fully anticipating that I would do a pre-med major.
Okay.
But this was 1966.
Right.
And there was a lot going on in 1966. I was in Indiana, and believe it or not, there were voter registration drives going on in 1960. And
were you at the University of Indiana?
No, I was at DePauw University in Greencastle, Indiana.
Oh, DePauw, yeah, okay, yep.
Yeah.
Okay.
So I was there for 2 years, but by then things were really getting politically, most young people that I knew were involved politically at that point. And one of the issues of the time was the Poor People's Campaign. And Earlham College was the center of the Poor People's Campaign. So I transferred to Earlham and became like a philosophy major or some such thing, but certainly wasn't going to keep pre-med going. Continued then to do domestic political work and also anti-war work. And then in the spring of 70, the U.S. invaded Cambodia. I think it was the invasion of Cambodia, the bombing of Cambodia, whatever, a big event in the war. And I dropped out in the middle of my senior year. At that I had moved from being a pre-med major to a philosophy major to an art major. And my air specialty in art was basket weaving. And I did have the sense at the time that I probably didn't want a degree in basket weaving, largely because I had no talent. There were people in my program who had a great deal of talent, and my sister's an artist, graduated from Earlham and had a spectacular career as a ceramic artist, but I had no talent, so this differentiated me from her. So I left and started working with a Friends Service Committee on their anti-war work.
Okay.
And continued to do anti-war work through the end of the war. But meanwhile, went back to pre-med at night school at the University of Pennsylvania.
Oh, okay.
So
and what motivated you to do that?
Well, because I knew the war was going to end, and then what was I going to be?
Right.
I was an untalented
right.
basket weaver, so I was
right. hoping.
But all of this had to do with providing medical services to the disenfranchised populations that I've been working with, through the Poor
okay.
People's Campaign and so forth. So medicine and politics sort of got melded very nicely together during those years of moving in and out of those two kinds of things. So after 2 years, I was able to get my degree in biology from the University of Pennsylvania and ended up at Yale Medical School.
Okay.
Now, why Yale Medical School? Because Yale was opening up its doors to women at about that time. It had opened its doors to undergraduate women a few years before. But
okay.
The graduate schools were opening their doors to women. So there was a cohort. There were more women in my class. There were 10 women in my class compared to like the 2 the year before. So,
right. And what year did you start medical school?
I started school in 73, the fall of 73.
Okay.
Sort of the thing that got added in those years was the emerging women's movement.
Yeah.
The consciousness raising groups and so forth and so on. And so I sort of moved throughout that whole political spectrum and then got involved peripherally, really, in the women's movement in New Haven. Since I was a medical student, it was sort of hard to be. It was at least hard for me to do much more than that.
Right.
But I was involved in the early consciousness raising groups. And I think that probably all those things put together sort of gets me to how did I get involved in violence against women? Because the issue at the time in the 1970s in the United States was the rape crisis movement.
Right.
And the emergency services and so forth, the women's movement was putting a great deal of pressure on both on police to do better prosecuting and also on hospitals to begin providing more sensitive care for women who'd been sexually assaulted and also to work more directly with the police to put together evidence that would hold up in court.
Right.
So there was this model of kind of women and violence and health, but it wasn't called women and violence. It was like rape and health.
Okay.
And there was no consciousness about abusive personal relationships. And interestingly
right.
enough, in spite of consciousness-raising groups across the country involving millions of women, the issue of violence in our interpersonal relationships wasn't on the agenda.
Right. It starts on the agenda in the mid-1970s, right, when you get the emergence of the battered women's movement.
That
right, a little later on.
Well, let's see, because Evan and I were involved in starting, and it must have been 74, 75, yeah. So it was in the early days that the shelter movements were started. They were not initially started by, with one notable exception, which was the first. Sharon Vaughn is a...
Yeah.
In Minneapolis.
I don't know her,
Sharon certainly is a feminist.
Her, yeah.
She's a feminist with a capital F and a little F and a hyphenated
right.
F. And she is. And actually, it was 2 years in the medical and we had known Sharon from anti-war work in Minneapolis.
Okay. Okay.
And when Evan Stark and I, were in California, I guess it was the second year, the second summer of medical school. So that means that would be summer of 75. And we drove back east and stopped to see Sharon on the way. And Sharon was upstairs in the attic writing grants, and the house was overflowing with women and children.
Wow.
And Sharon, what were you doing? Well, she'd been running a legal services hotline, and they were really able to answer most of the problems, except if you weren't safe at home.
Right.
And so if you weren't safe at home in Minneapolis, you went to Sharon's house.
Wow.
Or one of the various safe houses that was, you know, the precursor to the shelter movement.
Right.
And in the wake of that experience with Sharon, we came back, and I started work. I had to do a research project to graduate from medical school, and everybody was kind of, at this point, expected to be outlining their research projects. And what you really were supposed to do was to figure out what subspecialty you wanted to go in, and then you were supposed to find a professor who was doing research, and you were supposed to, you know, hook on to that professor and get mentored. And yeah, that's what you were supposed to, like, help a professor. And I didn't know anything about medical school, right? I thought, you know, you studied, you did the whatever. I didn't know anything about the culture of medical school. And I thought when you said you do a research project, you did a research project.
Right.
So I looked to see what was known about violence against women. It's all rape. Battered women. There was one article in the British, in the Lancet, which was an article on the injuries, a catalog of injuries that had been sustained by women who were in a shelter in England. Because you see, in the UK, and we later went to the UK, and they wanted to know all about the rape crisis because in the UK, they got involved in domestic violence while we were getting involved in rape crisis.
Okay, right.
So at any rate, so there was no medical, there was no U.S. medical literature. There's one there was a report by a guy named Warren Appleton about a year later in the Annals of Emergency Medicine. And I don't know what happened to Warren, because he wasn't later involved in the movement. But at any rate, so my initial research was sponsored by a guy named William Frazier, who was a director of the ER at Yale New Haven in the 70s. He was a plastic surgeon whose mother was on the YMCA board, the YWCA board.
Okay.
And the Ys were getting involved in the early shelter movement.
Okay.
So I think I think he was influenced by his mother to take me on.
Right.
And was very generous with time and resources and so forth. I mean, this was something his mother would like, right? So he was very generous in giving me space to work and so forth. But when I went to him and I said, I want to do and the only language I had was battered women. Now, we've come miles and miles and miles from that. But
right.
That was the language I wanted to do a research project on battered women. And he said, oh, that's wonderful. Because Barbara Moynihan, who's a nurse, has been working with the rape crisis team for now several years, and we haven't had a chance to pull together that data. And I said, no, I don't want to work on rape. I want to work on battered women. And he said, what's a battered woman?
Wow.
So that really started it off. And on a whim, you know, he had all the Xerox pages then it was triplicate carbon copies. So he had all the pink sheets, which were the third carbons from the emergency room visits. And it was his job to review all of them. as director of the ER. So I said, well, do you have any pink sheets? He said, oh, yeah, his last man's pink sheets. So I said, we got some time. Let's divide it up and see. So we divided up into men and women, and we went through, and it didn't take long before, because they were all people who come in with injuries. It was not the medical side of the ER. And it wasn't long before sort of it was obvious to both of us that something was going on.
Right.
That there were injuries that you just wouldn't expect, and
Injuries on women patients, right? And this is like that you were putting the pieces together about the question, what's a battered woman?
Right. And there were, you know, and there were women, you know, who'd been beat up, and there were women who had been brought in by police, and, you know, who'd been beaten up or been assaulted at the mall. And there's clearly a different language that was used to describe these people, or, you know, women who'd been slashed with a knife. You know, so even the language carried some assault, as opposed to, you know, cut finger on vegetable knife or something like that. You know, there was a different language that was used. So clearly there was something different going on in these cases.
Right.
And so what I ended up doing was, and it was also very clear that you couldn't get much from one ER visit.
Mm-hmm.
And if your question was, what's a battered woman, you could really get it from one ER visit.
Right.
So the methodology that I developed was that I would take an entire month of ER records, women's ER records, women who came with injuries, and I would get their entire medical record, which was all of their emergency room visits, all of their clinic visits to Yale New Haven clinics, all their hospitalizations and so forth and so on.
Okay.
Obviously, there's a lot of holes. Maybe they went to other hospitals and, you know, people criticized the early research for all of that, but that would have only made the early research even stronger. But anyway.
Right.
So you take this group of 400-odd women, and you get all of their medical records, and you start looking initially for every emergency room injury in that record. And you look at the record and you say, oh, it says she was beat up by her boyfriend. Well, that's a positive. That's pretty clear, right?
Right.
And then there's the one where she was hit with a fist.
Okay.
Well, probably if you were assaulted, like some of you didn't know, you wouldn't say you were hit by a fist.
Right.
You know, somebody would break into your house and beat you up, or somebody would, you know, try and snatch your purse. You know, there would
be something more of a story.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
Right. So we actually called those probables.
Okay.
And then there were things that were suggestive, like walked into a door and got two black eyes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But the story didn't add up. And then there was, you know, comes in at 6 o'clock, at 7 o'clock at night with a cut across her thumb, having been chopping vegetables. And that was a negative. And so quite independent of the women, we took these almost 3,000 injury episodes and independently cataloged each injury episode into one of those groups.
Wow.
And then we went back and we said, okay, then we re-aggregated them into their respective medical records and said, okay, this person has at least one positive episode in their chart. So we're going to call that a battered woman a positive.
Okay.
This one has a probable episode, but no positives. So those are going to be our probables.
Okay.
This one has suggestives, but no probables or positives. So those are going to be suggestive of better women.
Right.
And then these have nothing but negatives. So they're going to be not better women.
Okay.
Some of this kind of thinking was based on reading Henry Kempe's early child abuse work from the 1950s.
Okay.
And the model of how medicine sees but doesn't see is drawn straight from Kempe.
Okay.
So theoretically, the work owes a tremendous debt to Kempe, yes.
Not, yeah.
I mean, it doesn't theoretically owe a debt. It owes a huge debt to the theory
right.
in terms of developing the methodology. You know, and so then at that point, we had to have, and this is where Bill Fraser's support was so important. Not only did he assign a couple of nurses to help me with some of the secondary abstraction of the medical records, but he also provided funds for analyzing the data.
That's great.
Which at that point was on punch cards. You didn't even know what a punch card is.
Oh, right.
Do you? No, punch cards. And you took your boxes and boxes of punch cards over to the Yale Computer Center, and somebody climbed up on a ladder and put your punch cards in at the top.
Right.
You know?
Incredible.
It's amazing,
incredible.
Right?
Incredible. Yeah.
It turned out it was amazing. It turned out that the women who had a positive episode in their medical record had the highest average number of injury episodes as a group. They had the highest number of injury episodes.
Mm-hmm.
They would
Which
come
makes
in,
sense, right? Because they're in a cycle of violence.
If you believe that
right.
there is something called a battered woman, it does make
right.
sense.
Right.
You know, you have to sort of, you know, run backwards now 40 years and realize that there was no description of a battered woman.
That's right.
To realize that it's just sort of like the aha moment of this.
Right.
And I think the average number was, I don't know, 8 or 10. A lot of injury episodes.
Of injury episodes per woman, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And the probables, like, and the injury episodes that aggregated in the positive charts were positive, probables, and suggestives.
Right. Right. Of course. Now, were you just completely, like when you found this, did you have the aha moment, or what was the experience of, you know, putting this data together?
It was tremendously exciting.
Right.
I mean, you know, it was better than having your chemistry experiment come out exactly as it's supposed to. I mean,
right.
It was mind-boggling,
right?
That this simple idea actually worked,
right?
And that in fact you could divide this group into these, and that the average number of trauma visits decreased, you know, per woman, as you went from positives down to negatives, And basically, if you've been in the emergency room more than 3 times with trauma,
yeah,
there was an 80% chance you were in an abusive relationship.
Mm-hmm.
You didn't have to ask questions. You didn't have to do fancy algorithms. You know, all this world's worth of stuff on risk factors and so forth. You had to say, have you been here before with injuries? Or you just had to look at the record.
Right.
And so from that came what I came to call the adult trauma history, which in, you know, yeah, it was exciting to discover that domestic violence is represented in the medical record and that healthcare is an incredible resource that women in violent relationships turn to. And they don't just come for knife wounds and gunshot wounds. They come for a variety of injuries that you and I might not go to the emergency room for at all. We might just put a piece of ice on our head. But, you know, where are you going to be safe? In an urban emergency room, there's a pot of coffee, there's a security guard, and unless you're bleeding, you're going to be there for a very long time.
Right.
So the more we got involved, the more it made sense that women were using emergency rooms in all kinds of ways and that emergency rooms were really important. The understanding this and demonstrating that this population existed and that they told people that you know, some of the positives were from the doctor's writing, some of the positives were from the nurse writing, some of the positives were from the X-ray technician.
Okay.
So it wasn't difficult to get this, quote, admission from women. Which was that was the first part of research. The second part of it was, well, since we had their whole medical records, what else happened in their medical records?
Okay.
And that's where we began to link the experience of abuse with a broad range of health problems. Some of them directly related to abuse, like deafness or early onset of arthritis or neck pains from, you know, being held about the neck and having your, you know, head banged up against the wall, or concussions, symptoms of concussions with prolonged headaches and so forth, intractable sinus infections because your bones were broken and the normal sinus anatomy was disrupted. So, you know, as well as things like depression and suicide attempts and very, very late in the onset, after lots and lots of injuries, you begin to see alcohol, drug abuse, suicide attempts. Which was interesting because one of the few places that you saw domestic violence discussed was when a woman who was a known alcoholic came in all beaten up. Then she was an alcoholic beaten up by her boyfriend. Well, now we had an explanation. She was an alcoholic.
Yeah, because so that was the primary issue, which then led to the... Right, I mean, that was the interpretation. The primary issue is the alcoholism that leads to the beating, but not vice versa.
Well, that was, yes, that's how medicine could understand it.
Right.
If she's an alcoholic, yeah, I beat her up too.
Right.
I mean, as terrible as that sounds, that was kind of what the linguistic history looked like.
Yeah, absolutely. So you all are beginning to challenge that with this research in a really significant way.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And about that time, I finished in 77. So it must have been in 76. Connecticut had, and we were also by this time, our house was a safe house, and we were starting to work with a group of men and women from the welfare department, social services, a local church. We did a conference at the Y. So they were starting, but again, no feminists. Interesting, not the women's movement.
Fascinating.
It's so it really is interesting. And many probably would challenge me on that. You know, I think the nurses who were involved, I think, were more involved in the feminist movement, but certainly not on the ground and not in medicine. But at any rate, there were a series of speakouts about rape. I think it was about rape. It might have been about domestic violence in Connecticut. You know, these telephone call-in things.
Yeah.
Where you don't identify yourself, but you just. And so it must have been like 78 that the Connecticut legislature wanted hearings on this issue.
Okay.
And somehow this my research came up, and so my research was presented then. And
great.
And then there were hearings down in Washington at the Civil Rights Commission, and again I presented my research. But you know, I'm sitting here thinking, man, this is like medical student stuff. You can't really, you shouldn't like have federal policy based on medical student stuff. And so instead of going to a, traditional training program in, here it is. The hearings before the Subcommittee on Domestic and International Scientific Planning Analysis and Cooperation.
Wow.
Of the Committee on Science and Technology, the U.S. House of Representatives, February 1978.
Wow.
Research into violent behavior, domestic violence. And,
and that's where you presented your research.
Yep. Yep, and it's the only medical research.
That was my next question, because it seems like this research, like I know that other people start doing research, but it seems like yours is really the first research that we see, I mean, nationally even, that's taking on this issue in terms of like medical research.
Yeah, the other people were, the other physician, Eli Neuberger, was a head of the child abuse program in Boston.
Okay.
So he presented.
Was she working with Susan Schechter?
Susan Schechter's program, Susan was probably still in junior high school at this point.
Oh, yeah, because this is in the 80s, her
this
AWAKE
is
seven, program.
This is 78.
That's
78.
Oh, that's right. Her AWAKE program is in the mid-80s, early 80s.
I think she's still getting her degree.
Mm-hmm.
The hearings.
Oh, yeah, okay.
Yeah, the only So Eli and a couple of other pediatricians spoke. Must be a psychiatrist, Toby Myers, from Mental Health Services. And then Susan Steinmetz of Sociology, Lenore Walker, psychologist.
Oh, yeah, Lenore Walker. She's the battered woman syndrome.
Yeah, right. She spoke at those. And Strauss spoke Salim Shah from the centers of HEW and Tom Lally.
Okay.
Now the reason those two names are important is because, you know, I was presenting Anne Flickrup, postdoctoral fellow.
Right.
So because I didn't do an internship right away. I went into a postdoctoral fellowship at Yale, and during that year wrote, along with Evan, a much larger grant that was methodologically much tighter.
Okay.
With a real research group, and a budget for data analysis and so forth. And that was funded by, this is interesting, Tom Lally.
Okay.
And
how do you spell how do you spell Lowry?
Lally.
Lally. Oh, Lally. Okay, got it.
Tom Lally. And he was a deputy chief at then Health Education and Welfare, HEW.
Okay.
And his buddy at this talk was Salim Shah, S-A-L-E-E-M, SHAW. And he was at the Centers for the Study of Crime and Delinquency at the National Institute of Mental Health. So he worked with Tom Lally. Tom Lally was the overall director, and Salim Shah was the director of the Centers for Crime and Delinquency. And when we submitted our grant to the National Institute of Health, of Mental Health, the research grant, it was Salim Shah who then came to New Haven to do the site review.
Mm.
And it was Tom Lally who for years was the person that we would stay in touch with in Washington about the findings and so forth and so on. I had not realized until just now when I pulled this out that, in fact, Shah and Lally were the lead-off speakers for these hearings. That's interesting.
Interesting, yeah.
Interesting, so, yeah.
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 So not a surprise that they funded your research then. I mean, they're so, right? I mean, this is...
Well, it's interesting. I wonder whether or not that's where they sort of heard of it.
Huh, yeah.
Because I spoke a half a page later. So that was actually probably a very fortuitous hearing.
Yeah, absolutely. Sounds like it.
Because since there was no medical literature on battered women, it's very difficult to get a research program started. That's one of the
right, because you don't have the literature.
That,
yeah, you don't have the literature to justify the need for the work, et cetera, et cetera.
Right, right. Exactly.
Because what you're doing
is always easier to do somebody else's work again than it is to do original work.
Right, and break new ground. And I mean, because you're starting from a position where people don't even know what battered woman is. And, right?
Right.
So it's. And
in healthcare, they don't.
In healthcare, right. And that was another question I had for you. You know, Dr. Frazier was supportive of your work and affirming of what you all were doing. Did you get a sense of other people's response to the work? Did you get people just not clear on what you were doing or why or, you know, or did...
Well, it turned out my thesis was circulated among the secretarial pool at the medical school.
Wow.
The secretaries loved it.
Right.
The secretaries loved it. The critical reviewer, you know, who had to pass on it, you know, to review all these things and pass on it to let you go ahead and graduate, felt that the literature review was terribly thin.
Well, there's no literature on it, right? Correct. Right.
So, you know, and so it was an outlier then, and and the program that I applied to at Yale was a program on it was a program run by mental health people, psychiatrists and psychologists and so forth, and funded by the National Institute of Mental Health. It was on program evaluation. And one of the guys was very supportive, but the other guy argued against my coming into the program because he said, well, what does this have to do with mental health? It boggles me when I think about it in those, you know.
Although, I mean, that was the understanding at the time, right? Yeah,
it was no understanding, and therefore understanding all.
Right.
Right? If you didn't understand anything about it, then, of course, it didn't have any mental health repercussions.
Right.
But a part of my being trying to do the groundwork to get into this program, actually, this is an aside, psychiatry resident by the name of Bruce Roundsville, who by this time was trying to do some work over at the Community Mental Health Center to identify battered women.
Okay.
And he said, Ann, I'm having a terrible time. I can't find any battered women. I said, Bruce, it's ridiculous. I see them referred from the emergency room over there all the time. They got to be there. So I took a copy of Del Martin's book, Battered Wives.
Yep.
Okay. Yeah. And it had,
yeah, got it.
It had a black and blue cover. It was awful. And I sat in the coffee shop at the mental health center at the counter and ordered a cup of coffee and just set this book at my side. And in the span of an afternoon, I had wonderful conversation with half a dozen women who were, I can't say inmates, they were patients at the mental health center, who came over and said, "Oh, look at that. Liz, you want to hear my story?"
Wow, that's incredible.
So it was just like, so, it was so easy then.
Right.
Wow, and then, of course,
amazing.
As soon as the shelters opened up, I mean, people told all kinds of things about, and we came to really understand abuse in all of its manifestations and
right.
sort of in working in the shelter movements and so forth. But doing the research grant, we were then able to explore more direct relationships between suicide attempts and child
mm-hmm.
abuse and alcohol abuse and provide more validation to the original scheme of things. And it became clear in that because we had much bigger budget to do data analysis that the bulk of the medical care, that not only did battered women use a tremendous amount of emergency services, they use a tremendous amount of healthcare services.
Right.
And some of it was directly related to abuse. Some of it was related to their safety strategies. Women who would stop, Elaine Hilberman in Carolina has a story of a patient of hers who was on seizure meds, and the only time the guy would let her out of the house was when she had a seizure. So
wow.
when things were getting pretty intolerable, she would stop her seizure medicines.
Wow.
You know, the myriad layers of relationship to healthcare are just phenomenal.
Right.
So the work allowed us to expand a lot more into those kinds of areas and increasingly to understand it in terms of what Evan has come to call coercive control.
Okay.
Where we went with the research we told Tom after about two research rounds that we were done. We really wanted to move to training. And he said, you're not on the training track yet. You have to do 10 years of basic research before you do training. And he said,
wow,
we can't do that. We can't
do
that. Life is short. Life is short.
And this is while you're on your postdoc, right?
No, now, see, I did my postdoc for a year.
Okay.
We got the grant.
Okay.
And then I went into an internship.
Oh, that's right. That's right. Okay.
So I went into an internship and supervised the group from afar. And Evan was involved in it, too. So he was sort of the day-to-day. And but it was interesting when the work on suicide came out, when that piece got worked out. It was accepted for presentation at the American Public Health Association meetings, which are big meetings.
Great. Yeah.
And my program director would not give me time off to present the work.
Ugh. Wow. Why? Because was this director...
It didn't have anything to do with medicine.
With...
It didn't have anything to do with medicine.
Wow. Wow. Okay.
So I did a med-surg internship and... then Evan got a Fulbright to England. And I was sort of waiting around hoping that emergency medicine would open up because I thought that was going to be primary care for the poor. How wrong I was. But at any rate, So I left my clinical position. I withdrew from my second year position and went with Evan for a year to England.
Okay. And what year is this? Are we up
that
to...
would be 1980. 1980-81 academic year.
Okay.
Got much more involved in sort of DV over there, and
okay.
came back here, spent another year working on the research grant before I went back to my clinical work, at which time the self-same program director said, "I'm so glad you came back to medicine."
Huh. The same one who said that the suicide
right.
yeah, had nothing to do with medicine.
Right.
Wow.
Right.
Okay.
Right. So the research group kept going and I kept doing my residency and so forth. But then by 85, we decided we were going to like quit doing the research bit and developed with funding from the, what was it? The Connecticut. The Department of Public Health and Addiction
okay.
Services. Let's see, where did we first get funding for? That was to 83, 86. Yeah, the Connecticut Department of, first it was under the State of the Human Resources and then the Department of Public Health. So for 10 years, the training program at that we ran was supported by the core support came from Connecticut, and it was augmented by support from the March of Dimes and the Commonwealth Fund.
Okay, so that's a pretty significant shift then from the late 70s, where people are, you know, suggested that don't know what a battered woman is in terms of like medically speaking, and then in 85, the Connecticut Department of Public Health is funding you all to develop a training program.
It is amazing. And
yeah.
and I was sort of somewhere I came across it going through, I don't know. I mean, this is just like from late 89 to 90, early 93,
yeah.
there were probably 40 lectures that I did alone.
Wow.
And everywhere from national meetings of the American College of Physicians and the American Medical Women's Association to grand rounds at Harvard to symposiums in Saskatchewan, Canada.
Yeah.
Just everywhere. The National Meetings of the Society of General Internal Medicine,
right.
Emergency Medicine. So everybody was really wanting it.
So finally, it seems like after a decade of work and research in the late 80s, early 90s,
yeah.
There's growing interest. Obviously, still problems from the medical field, but it seems like you see a really significant change in that time period.
Oh, yeah, because by now there's a group of physicians, largely some brought together through the AMA initiative.
Okay.
The group that wrote the 1992
guidelines yeah.
and also
yeah.
The little green book. Do you have the little green book, the guidelines book?
I don't know. Okay.
I think it's probably just a pamphlet or booklet form of the
okay.
But it probably has some more stuff in it. I don't know where that is. But there were a group of physicians, women physicians who worked, mostly women physicians, who worked on that. And then that became the core within the AMA of a larger group that did work on similar pamphlets on child abuse and rape and domestic violence, all kinds of things like that.
Okay. So you all as physicians, like, did you get the sense that you were working mostly individually in different parts of the country throughout the 80s, and then you kind of all came together in the late 80s to do the guidelines within the AMA? Like, is that kind of the trajectory that's happening?
Yes, and it's brought together. I think one example of that is 85 is when C. Everett Koop.
Yes.
Brought everybody together into this national conference on injury control. But even then, it was another few years. It was really the AMA initiative in the 90s that brought a cadre of young women, some of whom were already involved, others of whom it became an opportunity, was really an organizing tool for them to become involved.
Okay. Yeah, and
so
I was going to ask you about
another group.
Sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off. I was going to ask you about that Surgeon General's workshop on violence and public health. You know, you and Evan wrote about, you know, domestic violence for the source book. And so what do you think was the impact of that event? Do you think it, you know, do you have any thoughts about that event or its aftermath? Or, you know, did you think it was really a critical, I mean, you've written that it was a critical moment. But if you could just expand a little bit about on like the impact of that workshop.
Well, you know, I think, you know, Koop's brilliance was to say that injuries are not accidents.
Right.
That up until 1985, they were synonymous, you know, in healthcare, everything else. I mean, healthcare, public health, and you had these kind of, you had the idea that, well, seatbelts might matter. So you had sort of industrial improvements that improved product safety.
Okay.
But it was through that product safety lens that any notion of engineering could impact injuries. And in 85, you still had the notion that it would be mechanical engineering that would make a big difference. Whereas, so some of it was about gun control. And obviously the engineering of guns, engineering of gun locks and so forth and so on. So there's still room for mechanical engineering on that. But from my perspective, I think what's important about the Koop's work is that he also, I hate to use the term social engineering, but he recognized the social milieu as a milieu that through policy, through law, through culture, in all different kinds of ways, you could shape, reconstruct family networks, school networks, and so forth into safer environments.
Okay.
And so you weren't left with just the the sick person with a gun. Was the source of gun injuries, right? You had much more complex notions of social causality and power and control between men and women and so forth. Do I think it made a matter? I think if Koop had stayed in, it would have made a big matter. But by the third National Injury Control Conference, and this boggled my mind this morning, the third Injury Control Conference, which is 1991. Okay?
Okay.
It's about motor vehicle accidents, motorcycle safety, crash avoidance, roadway safety, there is a
So is there nothing on violence and women?
There is the prevention of violence and injuries due to violence has now been subsumed into interpersonal violence as one category and suicide as another. And gender has completely disappeared.
Wow. So the first conference,
amazing?
So this is the third, so the first one is this 1985 conference on
mm-hmm.
violence and public health, and then 6 years later, it's all about motor vehicle crash safety, stuff like that.
And so-called interpersonal violence.
Wow.
Which is everything from gang violence to child abuse to, it's amazing. It's
well, it is amazing because the source book from 1985 is child abuse, child sexual abuse, rape and sexual assault, spouse abuse, violence against the elderly. I mean, that's the entire program.
Yes.
Right? And there's homicide and assault and violence, and then you get 6 years later, and that's, so what do you think is going on that, is it, what happened that, it's strange because at the same time that you see medicine beginning to address violence, you then see these this larger national conference, violence against women and battering, you then see this larger national conference start to dismiss it?
It disappears. Gender disappears.
Yeah, gender disappears. Yeah. Wow.
Gender disappears.
Yeah.
And the other thing that disappears is, I think it was a political decisions.
Okay.
About gender disappearing and about gun control disappearing.
Okay.
Because Art Kellerman, who was heavily funded, I think, by the CDC, but he was in Atlanta, he's an ER doc, did beautiful, beautiful work on gun control and looking at, he did a comparison study between Seattle and Vancouver. Those are the two cities on either side, right?
Yeah.
And Vancouver has gun control, Seattle doesn't. And just comparing murder.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it was a brilliant study, and it brought the NRA right smack down on top of his research.
Oh, yeah, that's not a surprise, right?
Yeah.
And yeah, I'm sure they were not happy with him.
Right. And in this, this basically highlights black males.
Okay.
And so you see, you know, gang violence, and you know, is that what we see now, with the extraordinary rates of imprisonment, incarceration,
mm-hmm.
and the development of a private prison system, a for-profit prison system,
yep.
to incarcerate a larger
right.
minority community.
Absolutely.
So that the politics of, and I'm being very, I mean, I don't really know this stuff about this stuff, but it just looks interesting.
Yeah.
In light of that. And there continued to be, I mean, you know, states took on family violence, and there's certainly, you know, a continuing and mounting awareness of family violence, but it's suspiciously absent from the Centers for Disease Control. And I don't know those individuals well enough to, you know, hear their side of the tale and what kind of pressures they were under.
Right, and why you see this disappearance by the early 90s.
But at the same time, the early 90s is then when the AMA got involved.
Right, exactly. So it's kind of, it's very complicated, right?
And the medical subspecialties became increasingly involved.
Mm-hmm.
And now I did come up with Martha Whitworth's name. Martha was a staff person at the AMA. And the real driving force who must be mentioned, where's my cards?
And Martha, is it Whitmer, W-H-I-T-M-E-R?
Whitmer, W-I-T.
Oh.
I said I would. All right, I'm going to have to send you. You want it in the video. I mean, you want it in the thing.
I can also do adjustments. We can add,
You can add things
after.
So I can.
Yeah, like
yeah,
if it's a name
okay.
that you're remembering. But Martha, I'm sorry, Martha's last name was W-I-T.
T, W-E-R.
Oh, yeah, Whitwer. Okay, got it.
Yeah, Whitwer. Let me see if it's in 314. Let me just see if it's in this issue.
Okay.
If they mention its name.
Yeah, I'd like to ask you some more questions about that AMA diagnostic and treatment guidelines that you co-authored.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously this is a really significant moment. So did you all see this as a moment of victory or... think considering the work you all had done, both individually and starting like as groups of physicians throughout the country, just the experience of having the AMA publish those guidelines, like what did that feel like for you?
Well, I think what felt really important was not only that they published the guidelines, but they had brought us together month after month after month to meet there and talk about what could be done, and to fill
mm-hmm.
in, fill their staff members in on what should be done, and which was a tremendous expense at their point, and which is why I have to find. You don't have the little green book right there with you, do you? Oh, wait. Here it is. No, the diagnostic and treatment guidelines are not the same as the scientific council ones. Okay. Now, Susan McClear was a ER doc who did really great early work in the emergency room in Philadelphia. And Carol Warshaw she's like a genius. She's triply boarded in ER psychiatry and internal medicine or something, and is a wonderful feminist and runs programs in Chicago. She was
okay.
very, but let me see. I know it was Roger. Okay. Marshall, M-A-R-S-H-A-L-L, D,
mm-hmm.
Rossman, R-O-S-M-A-N. PhD, is a PhD in sociology.
Okay.
And the second really active person was Roger L. Brown, PhD. But I don't know what his PhD is in. But Martha Whitwer, W-I-T-W-E-R, was a master's in public health. And Marshall was a staff person, had been for years a staff person at the AMA. Martha was more recently brought on. But this whole doing something about violence against women was a conspiracy by Marshall Rossman and
okay.
Roger Brown and Martha Whitwer to get the AMA involved. And they
so
did
they were
it,
really the movers and shakers.
They were the movers and shakers, and they shook
okay.
them. They shook the money tree out of the AMA, and they got the senior leadership of the AMA on board with all this stuff.
Wow, that's pretty incredible.
They were really amazing. Yeah, they found us. We came together and looked around, and we said, "My God, none of us are members of the AMA." Which didn't seem
wow.
to bother them at all. It didn't seem to bother them at all. But you'll notice that the scientific and treatment guidelines that are published in JAMA are written by the Scientific Review Committee of members who are all members of the AMA.
The AMA? Okay.
Yeah. Right.
Interesting.
Although yes, I mean, so there's some, but But Marshall was so great, and Martha was so helpful in doing any, you know, that we very quickly got over our whatever feelings we had about the AMA.
And right.
Thought they could do really good stuff. And I think it was on the back of the AMA's involvement that you then got the Joint Commission on the Accreditation of Hospitals.
Yes.
Which, you know, makes sure hospitals are clean and safe and so forth and so on, to begin putting in questions in emergency room services and other services in every encounter about are you safe at home?
Excuse me. So it's like the AMA guidelines kind of have this, I don't know if you would call it like a domino effect, like that happens and then that pushes the joint accreditation
yes.
to,
right.
okay, so this is,
right,
so
right.
this the AMA, this is a huge deal.
This gives
yeah.
the imprimatur of real medicine.
Okay.
This gives, I don't know how that goes, this gives the issue, the imprimatur of real medicine, but anyway, this,
yeah.
this says, violence against women, domestic violence, as it was called then, is real medicine.
Right.
And in the wake
wow.
of that, then, there's a guy named Ed Brandt, B-R-A-N-D-T.
Okay.
Who was at University of Oklahoma. He had been an undersecretary at HEW. And I can't remember, maybe in Carter's administration? He'd been an undersecretary
okay.
and then went out to then and then sort of then I think it was from Oklahoma after his Washington stint was over, went out to University of Oklahoma and was in like the dean's office or something like that. But he was very, very networked with the licensing, the whole process of how doctors get licensed and the licensing examinations and medical school curriculum, because that was the next place to go with it, was medical school curriculum.
Right.
And
okay.
The American College of Physicians wrote a whole text on... it's upstairs. I mean, of course, AMWA was very busy all this time.
Mm-hmm. So they're doing a text on the medical school curriculum or NDV?
I'm pretty sure it's just on... Maybe it's women's health generally.
You can go find it.
Yeah. Somewhere.
In the 90s seems to be, the early 90s, you also have the development of forensic nursing. It seems like the 90s is really like a boom time for...
Well, forensic nursing may have gotten its credentials in the 90s, but
right.
its roots go back to this woman, Barbara Moynihan, whom
mm-hmm.
Bill Frazier wanted me to work with in 1970 at Yale.
Oh, and she was the one doing rape.
She
rape
was the one who started
work,
the rape
right?
crisis team at Yale. Yes.
Okay. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, and
so.
I've spoken with Linda LaDre, who did the sexual assault nurse examiner program here in Minneapolis in 77,
uh-huh.
I believe. But yeah, the roots of forensic nursing are those SANE programs and
yes.
yeah, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah. Yeah.
yeah.
yeah.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
So you begin to see it move into the curriculum, and Ed Brandt hosted a meeting in, could it be Oklahoma City? On the question of what belongs in the medical school curriculum.
Mm.
And people like Elaine Alpert. Have you talked to Elaine?
No.
Elaine is at Brigham and Women. Uh, And, you know, do you have access to you can do a search for Elaine Alpert, right?
Yeah, I can find her.
In academic medicine? You have access to academic medicine?
I don't know that I have access. I mean, I might be able to through my networks, but I'm sure I could track her down somehow.
Yeah, she was
after
in
all,
the dean.
I did find you.
Yeah.
I feel like I can find people.
Elaine is... nuts. Sorry. I was just reading that book this morning.
But she was one of these people who was involved in the
She was very involved in the Oklahoma meeting.
Yeah.
Very involved in the Oklahoma meeting.
And is this Oklahoma meeting, are we talking like mid-90s at this point?
We must be.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. Because that seems to be like the next major frontier, I think, like in this story, right, is the curriculum and training medical personnel, physicians, nurses, et cetera, okay.
And it was Ed who taught us that if the questions were on the licensing boards, then the deans would put it in the curriculum. See, we all thought that sort of the way you'd get it in the curriculum would be you would convince people it was such an important thing and you couldn't take care of women very well unless you were able to do, you know, we thought that's how things worked. Well, no.
Right.
That's not how things worked.
Right.
You really couldn't care less about that. They wanted to know what were my students going to need to know in order to pass the exam.
Exactly. So, yeah, so that's the strategy. It's like get it on the boards, and then you can get it in the curriculum. It's
exactly.
About whether it's important or not, it's about the test.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Okay.
So that's how that went.
Okay.
So that's how that went.
Okay.
And I think, and it's about that time that I got more and more involved in my clinical work.
Okay.
Less and less involved in doing training stuff. And Elaine really did a tremendous amount in terms of training. She went on to work with the Massachusetts Medical Society and did a whole set of CDs.
Okay.
Tell where she is from. Let me see.
And then, a few more questions taking us back into the 80s after you figure out Elaine Alpert's.
I would try and track her down through the Massachusetts Medical Society.
Okay.
But
good.
She's an MD and an MPH. And it's
MD,
A-L-P-E-R-T.
Okay, that's great. Thanks.
Mm-hmm.
So going back in the, looking in the late 70s and the 1980s, and so you see physicians working mostly individually, and correct me if I'm wrong on this, you have nurses working mostly individually, social workers are getting involved, MPHs, you know, or people with, you know, masters in public health. And do you see, I mean, is there any collaboration between, say, physicians and nurses, or are you all mostly working separately? You know, I'm trying to piece together this history.
Well, the nurses were very well organized. I'm sure Jackie's talked to you about the National Nursing Network.
I have an interview. I did not interview her, but I have the interview that somebody from the National Library of Medicine did with her. And I interviewed Dan Sheridan, so I have the sense of the nurses' story. Yeah.
Right, right. So I think the nurses were... it was never domestic violence. Violence against was not an area where, because it wasn't accepted by medicine,
right?
Like my chairman, after I got promoted to associate professor, said to me, "Well, you'll have to be the queen bee of something else to get promoted to full professor."
Wow.
So it wasn't an issue. And Elaine, for instance, who was also on a tenure-track position, she moved over to administration. And then as an administrator, she was much freer to pursue that as a professional.
Okay.
You know, that she wasn't, that her dean promotions didn't come from the quality of her work, but rather probably to a certain extent the quality of her community contributions, which were tremendous.
Right. And when you had this person say to you, you have to be the queen bee or something else, what year are we, or was this, what year are we talking?
We're
here?
Talking, we are talking we must be talking 2000.
Oh, that late? It's 2000?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Now, maybe, I mean, okay. and it's just not an issue. While there are, in pediatrics, there are many, many prestigious pediatricians who've been promoted and their life work is in work with abused children.
Right.
But in internal medicine, it's not a recognized. Now maybe if I lived my life over again and I did clinical work with women who were in an abused relationship and had a team, like Susan Schechter's team with child abuse.
Right.
But I worked at a little clinic. That wasn't going to happen.
Right.
So I can't really, I think it was a lot of individuals and we knew each other.
Yeah.
We liked each other. But we didn't have a national organization that did research and published research articles and so forth and so on.
Right.
We drew upon each other to do rounds in each other's hospitals.
Okay.
My impression is that the National Nursing Network was much more organized.
Yeah. Okay.
And I think it had to do with the fact that you could get promoted.
In nursing, right.
Yes, right.
Whereas you all couldn't get promoted because the issue wasn't taken seriously enough.
Right.
At your
level.
Well,
I mean, and you have to realize that, you know, sort of, well, that the position of women in medicine, too.
Of course.
That we were not the first generation of women. There's certainly a huge number of women who'd come before us.
Right.
But to, I guess, maybe to come out on feminist issues as women in medicine, it was, I didn't do it.
Yeah. Right. Well, I mean, you did, right, in doing all your work on abused
but
women.
But I did it in part because, in large part because I felt like, and still feel like, some woman comes to you, to your office with a headache. How can you even begin to know what the headache is from if you don't ask her if she's in a relationship where she's hurt or frightened, or when there's fights at home, is she hurt or afraid, or in the past, has she been in a
right.
Has she suffered? Like, how do you have to do that? Or somebody
right.
who's, you know, 30 and their right shoulder is totally gone and they were not a high school and a college softball pitcher. Well, how
right.
did your right shoulder get so continually injured? You have to ask. Have
right.
you suffered injuries? You know, you just can't take care of people without knowing their adult trauma history.
Right.
But,
although in the 70s, that wasn't the concern, right? I mean, I've got, I think it's
that's right.
quote
that's
that I
right.
pulled
and
from
to a
one
certain
of your
extent,
articles of, yeah.
And to a certain extent, you know, that's sort of where I parted with eventually kind of my interests began to part from other people's interests,
mm-hmm.
who were more focused on violent, you know, providing safety for women and safe encounters and so forth and so on, that I really saw it as something that needed to be deeply embedded in the basic, hello, my name is Doctor, and how can I help you framework.
Right.
Because otherwise, I don't believe you can understand what makes the people you're taking care of tick.
Yeah.
You know, so, and that continues to be the most interesting piece of it to me.
Okay.
Anyway.
Like the piece of really getting at the root of the issue, which is the most interesting to you?
It's how profoundly being abused, whether you're being physically hurt, being emotionally hurt, being psychologically constrained, however you want to say it.
Right.
The profound effect that has upon your health and well-being.
Okay.
And therefore, one who is involved in facilitating health and well-being needs to know
right.
whether that particular issue is functioning in your self-capacity.
Right. Okay.
So I think... Anyway, so I read a lot of medical humanities these days.
Yeah, I can imagine.
Well, because I think literature is well aware of the ways in which coercion and control create tragedy.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And constrain well-being.
Right.
Oh.
Okay.
You have
so
more
the
questions?
Work continues.
Yes.
Well, let's see. We've been on the phone for about an hour and a half, so I do want to be aware of your time. But this has been really great to get, you know, a sense from the physician's perspective of, you know, and particularly with somebody who was one of the very first to be doing this cutting edge research, and to get a sense of this change over time in the medical profession. So I really appreciate all this information. It's really awesome, for lack of a better word, to hear this history from you. I mean, it is awesome in terms of what you've been able to do, you and other physicians and nurses. And so, I really appreciate talking to you. Also, you know, that you think of, that you forgot to add, that you want to mention or whatever, you know, feel free also to shoot me an email and we can make sure everything gets in the record.
Okay.
Yeah, that's great. And thank you so much. This has really been amazing to hear your story and your life's work, and I really appreciate it.